Well, I have a confession to make. I have actually an addiction. And so I'm just going to lay it on the line here. I have an addiction to ice cream. This is a safe place. Is there anyone else here who would admit and confess that you too share an addiction to ice cream? Raise your hand. Oh, look. I embrace you, brothers and sisters. I'm not the only one. I've been married for almost 20 years, and my wife quickly discovered that it was probably best if she kind of took care of the grocery shopping for our family, because she wasn't always happy with things that I would come home with. But, we had a really important talk early on in our marriage, and I said, honey, as the man of the house, I have to buy the ice cream. And so when I go to the grocery store, I don't know what your grocery store looks like here, but we have the big refrigerated aisles. And I know when I'm getting closer to the ice cream section. I don't know if you have the similar experience that I do, but I know I'm getting closer because the lights in the ice cream section get brighter as I approach. And I hear these angelic voices singing, Alleluia. And so I'll go and I'll stand in front of the ice cream section for, two or three hours and just to meditate a little bit. But I have a particular kind of ice cream that I lock in on. It's my favorite kind of ice cream. In fact, you can see it right there. All of them. That's my second favorite. My favorite is Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream. That, all they do is take a candy bar, smash it together, put it in vanilla. That's all you got to do. It's amazing. And in fact, the Lord has been so good to us. He's provided it in so many different forms, right? In fact, I've come to think that this may be the most powerful argument for God's existence right here. The argument goes like this. Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream exists, therefore God exists. I mean, that's seems like an open and shut case to me, right? So, so you're like, why are we talking about ice cream? Well, here's what I want to do. I want to make a couple of claims about ice cream. Test you a little bit, and talk about the mindset of modern Americans. So, here's my first claim. Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream is delicious. If you think that claim is true, simply raise your hand. Let's do a little survey. Raise your hand, okay? Yeah, all the Christians raising their hands. It looked like there were people who were not raising their hands, so actually, if you would be willing to identify yourself, if you think this statement is actually false, would you raise your hand if you think this is false? Okay. Well, we have Bibles for you guys afterwards that we will get to you. Okay, now think about it. Here we have a claim that is both true and false at the same time. How does that work? I mean, how can we have a claim that's true and false at the same time? Now, it seems like if someone disagreed with me on this claim, let's say I make the claim, Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream is delicious, and you disagreed with me, and we got into a conversation about it. Seems like if I looked at you and said, well, are you struggling with sin or something? Is that the problem? Is that why you don't like this kind of ice cream? You know, if that was my response, you'd think, wait a second, that seems a little over the top, right? That just doesn't seem quite appropriate for this topic. Okay, it seems like this is the kind of thing where we might say, you've got your favorite flavor, Brett has his favorite flavor, and we're okay with that. We're okay that you don't like mine and I might not like yours, but not a big deal. And it doesn't seem like we're going to spend a lot of time trying to persuade each other that you've somehow got the wrong flavor of ice cream, right? Now, let me make a second claim about Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream. Here it is. Let's think through this one. Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream is a medicine that will cure your diabetes. How many of you think that statement's true? Raise your hand. Okay, you have a non-diabetic over here. How many of you think the statement is false? Raise your hand. Yeah, and I'm guessing that probably the vast majority of us are not doctors. We don't have some kind of medical background. But we all seem pretty confident to say that that claim is false. In fact, what is the medicine that the diabetic is going to use to help control at least their diabetes? It's insulin, right? It's you don't inject ice cream, you inject insulin. And so now if you did think that this claim was true, it seems like the kind of thing that we would be willing to disagree with you on, right? We're going to say, no, I think you're wrong about that, especially if you're my diabetic friend and you think that you can eat, you know, 3 bowls of ice cream every single day and that will cure your diabetes, then we're going to have a disagreement. And I'm going to tell you that you are wrong. And even if you tell me that you're right, I'm going to continue to persist to tell you that you're wrong. We're not going to say, I'm not going to respond by saying, well, okay, if that's true for you, that's fine. You know, I guess I just have a different version of truth. No, we think, no, your views are false and my views are true on this. And we might then try to convince you. We might take you to a doctor or a medical researcher to try and show you that your view is wrong on this. And so what these two claims help us to do is they help us to distinguish between two different ways that a claim can be true. The first claim, Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream is delicious, is what we would call a subjective claim, right? And that would be a subjective truth. What's a subjective truth? It's something that's true for the person who's speaking or true for the subject, right? So I am the subject, Brett Kunkel is the subject, and when I say Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream is delicious, that's true for me. And what is it depend? What's the truth of that dependent upon? It's dependent upon me. It's dependent upon my personal preferences. It's dependent upon a subject. The truth of that is grounded in the preferences of a subject. Does that make sense? Now think about this. Subjective truths, by their very nature, are things that can change, can't they? Because they're grounded in a subject. And I may eat so much Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream over the next year that maybe a year from now, I look at Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream and I'm disgusted by it because I just overeaten it. And so I might think, oh, Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream is disgusting. All right. And so these are truths that can change. They're not things that we would say are always right or always wrong. And I think the key word to help us remember what a subjective truth is that it is a personal preference. Subjective truths are personal preferences that we hold. And so the truth of them is dependent upon the subject who is making the claim. But that's very different than the claim that insulin is a medicine that will help control diabetes. Insulin is a medicine that helps control diabetes is an example of what we would call an objective claim. And if something is objectively true, that means it's true for the thing itself or true for the object, right? And so philosophers would say objective truths are mind independent. They're independent of what any mind thinks. So they're not subjective. They're objective. It depends on the nature of the object. And so the claim, insulin is a medicine that controls diabetes, what is that claim about? That claim is about the insulin. But the claim, Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream is delicious, what is that claim about? It's not about the ice cream, it's about me, you see. And so when when the claim is about the subject, you have a subjective claim. When it's about the object, you have an objective claim. Okay. Now, objective truths are the kind of truths that do not change. These are not merely subject to the whims of our preferences, but objective truths are true whether you believe them or not. So it doesn't matter what any subject believes about the matter. They're true whether anyone believes them or not. Okay. So do you understand that distinction between objective claims and subjective claims? Because what I want to do is give you a test. So are there any questions on that? Any confusions? Okay, so you're ready for the test then, right? Okay, here we go. We're going to test you. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put up a claim. You simply identify the claim as either an objective claim or a subjective claim. So if I said, that guy's shirt is red, is that an objective claim or a subjective claim? It's an objective claim, right? Notice the truth of that is dependent upon the object. It's grounded in the object. Is the shirt actually red or is it not? Now, what if we said red is the best color? It's a subjective claim, right? That would be a personal preference of a subject. 2 + 2 = 4. That'd be an objective claim. Tropical island vacations are the best kind of vacations. Okay, here we have another subjective claim, depending on the subject. How about this claim? Brett Kunkel can bench press 350 pounds. I think I heard someone say false. I don't remember that being an option. My feelings are kind of hurt that that statement was met with all kinds of laughter. Okay, now, is this an objective claim or a subjective claim? Listen, okay, now, if any of you are going, well, both, it's both. No, it can't be both, it's one or the other. That's a great question. Now, would I have to prove it for the claim to be objective? I would have to prove something. So, let me give you a counterexample then. At a time when we could not prove the shape of the world, did that mean there was no objective truth about the shape of the world? So then the objective truth of something was independent of the ability to prove it or not. Okay? Are there things that could be objectively true right now that we just don't know and we can't prove, we just haven't discovered? Yes. Okay, so here's an important distinction. Something that is objectively true, remember how I phrased it, is true whether anyone believes it or not. But our ability to prove whether something is objectively true is a different issue. Okay? Whether something is true or false is primary, and then our ability to prove it is secondary. But that does our ability to prove something or our inability to prove something does nothing to the nature of the claim. So think about it. This claim is either true or false, whether I can prove it to you or not. Right? And so there's no way I could really prove that to you right here in this room. But that doesn't change the truth value of this claim, does it? No. Now, we might say, okay, well, we won't believe it until it's proven. Okay, well, that's fine. But whether it's true or false is not dependent on our ability to prove it. That's a really important distinction. Okay, now you might say, okay, but let's try to prove this. Okay, so we could maybe find a local gym, right? Go down to the gym, we'll put 350 pounds on the bench press, and boom, I'll show you what's up. I'll show you that the claim is absolutely false, okay? Yes, clearly I cannot bench press 350 pounds, okay? But my ability to prove something doesn't change the nature of the claim. So this would be an objective claim. Now, I think that's really important because it could be that there are many of us in here who actually believe certain objective truths. But we haven't yet quite developed the knowledge and the ability to prove those things. And now that I think that's an important thing to address, but it doesn't mean that it follows that your view is false just because you can't prove it. Okay? Because I know there's all kinds of Christians, especially young people who go off to college with maybe true beliefs, and yet they don't have the ability to justify or give reasons for those beliefs. And all you have to do to rattle them is to simply show that they don't have any good answers. You don't even have to show that their claims are false. You just have to show that they can't back it up. And that is enough to rattle a lot of our young people. Okay, so we've got another claim here. Atoms consist of protons, neutrons, and electrons. What kind of claim is that? Would be an objective claim. Okay, how about number 7? What if I said God exists? Objective or subjective? Well, Oh, there's some disagreement. I like this. Let's debate. How many of you think this claim is objective? How many of you think this claim is subjective? Okay. All right. I heard some more subjective, but I think they saw so many people said objective. They're like, okay, I can't raise my hand. All right. Well, what if I made this claim? What if I said Jesus is the only way to God and Orthodox Jews are wrong about his identity? Is that an objective claim or a subjective claim? Okay, let's take either one. Let's separate them out. Jesus is the only way to God, and all other gods are false gods. And Jews are wrong about the identity of Jesus. These objective or subjective? Okay, hearing a little bit of both. Okay, you're saying it's okay whether you believe it or not, it's true. It's objective. What if I made this claim? What about claim number 9? Sex before marriage is morally wrong. Objective or subjective? Objective. Not everyone agrees on this one. Objective? Subjective? Okay, we got some differences. How about this? It is wrong for women to have an elective abortion. Is that an objective claim or a subjective claim? All right, so we have some differences of views here. Now, the disagree. So it seemed like 1 through 6, pretty much no problem, right? Kind of consensus on that one. 7, 8, 9, and 10, there seemed to be a little more kind of questioning. There wasn't kind of the confident, objective or subjective answer that we had in 1 through 6. So what's going on here? And now, in the typical Christian audience, when I give this test, you can kind of take that disagreement and kind of multiply it, magnify it by, you know, 100%. I was just doing this with a Christian high school in Southern California, and then also a Christian junior high. And when you got to 7, 8, 9, and 10, man, it was split. And in fact, a lot of the students in the group claimed that 7, 8, 9, and 10 were merely subjective. Okay, and so now this group is, I mean, you guys have been, you're being trained well, right? So, but I would argue that this the claims 7, 8, 9, and 10 are all objective claims. They're all objective claims. Now think about it. What are the claims about? But in the first, in claim number 7, if I say God exists, what is that claim about? It's a claim about God. It's a claim about an object outside of me. Okay? In fact, the claim that God exists is really no different than the claim that this podium exists. It's the same kind of claim. It's a claim about an object outside of me. Or, as I mentioned, it's mind independent. So what I mean by that is that this podium exists or doesn't exist independent of what I think, independent of what my mind takes to be the case. That's what we mean by mind independent. It's objective. And in the same way, the claim that God exists is not a claim about a physical object. It's a claim about an immaterial object, but it's still a claim about an object outside of me. Now, whether the claim is true or false is the second question. We're not asking whether the claim is true or false. I just want you to identify, is the claim an objective claim or a subjective claim? An objective claim is going to either be true or false. Objective claims are either true or false. Okay? So, can people disagree on these things? Absolutely. But our culture says, well, if you disagree on these matters, well, then you can't say that anyone has the truth. But that is, in logic, we call that a non sequitur. That means it doesn't follow. Just because there's disagreement on a question it doesn't follow that there's not a right answer. That'd be like saying, well, hey, there's disagreement on whether or not 2 plus 2 equals 4. Some people say it's 5, some people say it's 6. So therefore, we can't conclude that there's one right answer. That's the same logical reasoning here. So disagreement does not prove anything. In fact, we have all kinds of examples, like the shape of the earth is an example historically of people who affirm different views, and yet there is still an objective truth of the matter, right? And so God exists. Does God exist? That's an objective claim. It's a claim about an object. Jesus is the only way to God. That's a claim about Jesus and the nature of Jesus. Okay? Sex before marriage is morally wrong is the claim about an object, an action, a moral action outside of me. And abortion, the same thing. So it's important to ask, well, what's that claim about? Is it about an object outside of me? Or does it have to do with my personal preferences as a subject? Okay? And so let me pause here. Questions, comments, clarifications? Yes? It would be independent of what any mind affirms or believes. So whatever I believe does not change an objective truth. It's independent of what anyone believes. Another way to put that is it's true whether anyone believes it or not. That's what we mean by mind independent. Yeah. Okay, so the claim would not be subjective. The claims, remember, the claim is an objective claim or it's a subjective claim. And on this claim, if you wanted to add, then that's why I put elective in there, because an elective abortion would be one that where the woman's life is not in danger. But even if we said it's wrong for a woman to have an abortion even if her life is in danger, that would still be an objective claim about the nature of that abortion. Okay. Now, we might say that claim was false. So objective claims are either true or false. And so that's another important distinction here. So claims are either objective and subjective, and they're either objective claims are either true or false. Okay. Any other clarifications? Yes. Well, even that claim would be a claim about the nature of you and what you're thinking. So even the claim you said, if you said, I think that abortion is wrong, that would be a claim about from an outside observer, we would say, well, that's a claim about what your mind affirms, what you affirm. So now there's a little imprecision here. Philosophically speaking, there's one sense where actually every claim would be an objective claim. But we're being a little imprecise here to kind of capture, I think, to try and help us understand these notions. So now you would say, if you said, take a meal. That steak is more delicious than that hot dog. That would be a kind of a subjective claim. Okay, so subjective claims are personal preferences. Objective claims are facts. Another way to think about it. Yes. Yeah, good question. So is this true of God? Well, yeah, I would say that there is reality independent of God, right? And so this is where in the Christian worldview, we see a distinction between the creator and the created, right? And so in other views, kind of in monism or, you know, other views you may, or panentheism, you would have kind of the combining of these things where there is no distinction between God and the created. We might say God is all. And so God is in the tree. He's in the, you know, he's in the chair. He's in you. He's in me. But the Christian view holds that God is distinct from his created reality. Now, what we would say is that, yeah, there are realities that exist, but that we would say God just knows all true propositions. So if God is omniscient, God knows all true things. God doesn't have any false beliefs. And so that's... It would clarify that question. Oh, okay, yeah. So, well, I would say moral claims are objective, they're objective claims. So I would say, the distinction still holds to the nature of reality, okay? We would just say that when it comes to, God's moral views, these are just objectively true. So if God, the reason we think sex before marriage is morally wrong is because that is the fabric of the universe. That's the nature of the moral universe that God has created. So I wouldn't say these are independent of God. I would say that actually God is the source of all objective truth. And that might be the way to cash this out, is that God is the source of all truth is grounded in God. All reality is grounded in God. Right, so when we're talking about the nature of moral truth, some Christians would hold a view, some kind of divine command ethics, but you would, I would say that the nature of morality is grounded in the moral nature of God. The nature of rationality is grounded in the rational nature of God. So another way to put it is all truth is God's truth. God is the source of all truth. Go ahead. Clarify. Without using some objectivity? Well, I think you can just say that all truth claims with God are objective claims. So, I don't know. I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head here to help clarify this. But I would say, let's see. I mean, objectivity applies to God, right? Number one, he exists, right? And there are certain things that he is the source of. So it's mind independent. That means I don't think I would characterize it as outside of the mind, as it's not affirmed by a mind. Okay, so a mind doesn't have to think it to be the case. Now, the question is, with an omniscient being, we would just know that necessarily that mind would affirm all true propositions. But it doesn't seem to me that now we're maybe talking about necessary and sufficient conditions, getting into some philosophy. I'm not sure I want to go there. I guess what I would say is that God knows all true propositions. God knows all objective truths. And he is actually the creator of all reality. So in that sense, as the creator of all reality, all objective reality is grounded in him. Okay? So maybe you and I can we'll take this one offline. We'll chat a little bit more. And maybe I'm missing something. Yeah, go ahead. Okay, so think about that claim. I am praying that you come up with the right answer. Well, that's an objective claim about what you're doing, about the action you're taking, right? So are you actually indeed, notice that's either true or false. You are either praying for that or you're not praying for that, okay? And so that would be an objective claim. Okay, we'll take one or two more, yeah. Yeah, that would be an objective claim about the nature of this moral action. So notice, it's a claim about that action. That action is independent of you or I. And so it's a claim about the moral status of that action. So that would be an objective claim. Now, objective claims are true or false. So in this case, someone might say, well, sex before marriage is perfectly okay. Now, that's an objective claim. I would just say it's an objectively false claim. And so we might now then have a conversation about, okay, is it true or false? Is that claim actually true or false? Is that morally right or morally wrong? Okay. All right, but one more clarification, then we'll move on. Right, okay. And so we might say, it depends on what someone means by opinion, okay? Often, in kind of common conversation, we would actually use the term opinion to refer to someone's, just their personal preference. And so often an opinion is designated as subjective. In fact, that's a really good kind of segue here, because that is what people will do to a lot of our claims on this. So they'll say 7, 8, 9, and 10 are just your opinion. And I want you to see what's going on with that. Now, notice, this is a really important conversation to have and to kind of try and wrap our minds around. Now, because I want you to see that these ideas about truth, they have consequences. They have huge consequences. Okay? Now, notice, when we got to 7, 8, 9, and 10, go back to that slide, that's where you're going to find lots of kind of disagreement and conflict, even with amongst Christians. What happened? Why, when it came to 7, 8, 9, and 10, why not 1 through 6, but why 7, 8, 9, and 10? Well, because we switched categories. Notice, what category did we move to with 7 and 8? We moved to religious claims, didn't we? 9 and 10 are moral claims. And so I want you to see what happens when Americans start talking about moral and religious claims. Okay? There's a shift that takes place. It's like there is a kind of a switch in the mind that can get flipped. And the default position is that these things are merely subjective. These are subjective, and that's why people say, well, that's just your opinion. All right? Now, let me give you a little test here. You've got a worksheet there. I'm going to give you a little test. Okay? On your sheet of paper, I want you to take a couple minutes, and here's what I want you to do. I want you to simply list the attributes of God. List the attributes of God. And just come up with as many as you can. List what are the attributes of God. So what are the, you know, God's, you know, properties? What are the things that describe who he is and what he's like? And then you can't double up on these. You can't say, well, God is love. God is caring. All right? You want independent attributes of God. So take a minute or two here and just start listing them. What are the attributes of God? Anyone need more time? Okay. So how many did you get? How many did you get down there? So how many are around 10 or so attributes? Okay. How many are 10 or less? How many are 10 or more? Can we get 10 or more? 15? 15 or more. Can we get 15 or more? Okay. All right. Okay, so if you take any standard kind of systematic theology book and you look and see, okay, what are the kind of the standard attributes of God? You may have some differences, you know, in different ways it's characterized in some different, systematic theologies. But generally speaking, you're going to get a list like this. Okay, this list comes from Wayne Grudem's systematic theology, which is just kind of a standard evangelical systematic theology test, or text. But Grudem lists 25 different attributes of God. There are 25 different attributes of God. So take your list and compare it to this list and see kind of how well you did. How many of us, we were kind of given this test and we're graded on this test, may have scored pretty low on this test? Okay? Yeah, the majority of us, right? I would say often when I kind of give this test, you know, especially with young people, it's like, well, 6, 8, 9 kind of attributes is what they list. But they're unaware of a number of the other attributes of God. Now think about the situation for a second. Think about the situation. So when it comes to our knowledge of God and who He is, if we can only list less than half of His attributes, that seems that that is going to give us a deficient view of God, don't you think? I mean, think about the implications for our relationship with God. If you said to me, Brett, tell me, what is your wife like? You guys have been married almost 20 years. What's your wife like? And I said, oh, yeah, my wife, Erin. Well, my wife, Erin, she's 5'6". She has brown hair. She has two eyeballs. Yeah, that's my wife. That's my wife, Erin. You probably look at me and go, tell me more about your wife, Brett. That's all I got. Well, aren't you going to draw some conclusions about my relationship with my wife if that's all I can tell you? Yeah, because we know that knowledge is somehow connected to relationship. Okay? It's not the whole deal, but there's certainly a connection. And in the same way, why would we, who are Christians, who would say we are followers of Christ, we would say that God is the most important thing, right? God is above all, and we might say the knowledge of God is the most important thing. Why can most Christians not tell us who God is? Why isn't theology for a Christian family, why isn't theology the most important area of study that they are encouraging their children in? Why is theology an area of study where probably the least amount of time is given week in and week out in your typical evangelical family? Now, this might not apply to you. Maybe it does. But why is that the case? Well, I want you to listen to how Charles Spurgeon, right, the great theologian, I want you to listen to how he talks about the knowledge of God, because I think it's very different than how we talk about it now. He says, he who often thinks of God will have a larger mind than the man who simply plods around this narrow globe. The most excellent study for expanding the soul is the science of Christ and Him crucified, and the knowledge of the Godhead in the glorious Trinity. Nothing will so enlarge the intellect, nothing so magnify the whole soul of man as a devout, earnest, continued investigation of the great subject of the deity. It's not often that you will hear pastors or leaders talk about the knowledge of God in this kind of way. I mean, when was the last time you heard someone talk about the science of Christ? Maybe never. And there's a very different view here. And now something is going on. Something's going on. And I want to get to what is that kind of that deeper view that affects not only people outside, but inside of the church. So here's, okay, let's keep cashing this out. Let's keep teasing this out. Think about the word faith, okay? On your worksheet there, define the word faith. If someone said, okay, you're a Christian, right? Faith is an important part of that. What is faith? How would you define faith? What is your view of faith? Go ahead and write that down. Okay, so let's get a couple definitions of faith. The first one I'm going to show you is actually from that classic Christian Christmas movie, Miracle on 34th Street. Maybe you remember the scene where the little girl is, you know, talking to her mom about Santa, and they're having a conversation about Santa and what it takes to believe in Santa.
Couldn't get it because you're not Santa Claus, that's why. You're just a nice old man with whiskers, like my mother said, and I shouldn't have believed you.
I was wrong when I told you that, Susie. You must believe in Mr. Kringle and keep right on doing it. You must have faith in him.
But he didn't get me. That doesn't make sense, Mommy.
Faith is believing in things when common sense tells you not to.
Huh?
Oh. I can't remember if I edited that at all, but it certainly needed to be edited, right? That was the proper response. What was the definition? Faith is believing in things when common sense tells you not to. And I'm no longer surprised that that is a definition that many Christians hold. Faith is believing in things when there's no evidence. Of course, we expect this from the skeptic. Sam Harris says, faith is generally nothing more than the permission religious people give one another to believe things strongly without evidence. That's how people from the outside look in and they see faith. Faith, well, that's what you believe when there's no evidence. That's when you believe when there's not kind of a rational argument. In fact, this is a former pastor. I don't know if he's a former pastor. John Wilkinson wrote a book called No Argument for God, Going Beyond Reason in Conversations About Faith. And this is what he says. This is from a Christian. The Christian message, in all its bizarre glory, comes from across the sea, beyond the horizon. We heard it from someone else, who heard it from someone else, who heard it from the person who saw it all. The only thing different about people of faith is that they choose to believe the testimony handed down to them. The only thing they have is faith, which is absurd, but that's okay. And all of the things that come with it, prayer, worship, charity, sacrificial love, all of it too is nonsense. And so he's working off this definition of faith as somehow faith is completely divorced from reason. And this is often how it's pitted, right? You have faith on one side, you have reason on the other. And so we actually have terms to describe this. In order to believe the things that Christian people believe, you have to take a leap of faith, right? It's a leap of faith, or it's blind faith. Because you're believing it, and there's no evidence. So blind faith means on one side you have this thing called faith, on the other side you have things like knowledge, reason, evidence, proof, rationality, and those two things are completely different, right? And I think what our culture has done is taken this idea of faith, right, and has subjectivized it. It's simply in the subjective realm. And so when it comes to claims about God, when it comes to theology, when it comes to our moral views, well, those things are simply things that people like you take on faith. And so what ends up happening is our minds are divided, and we live in a two-story house. What do I mean? Well, this is a term that, an illustration that Francis Schaeffer used to help us understand the mindset of the culture. And so here's the analogy. You have a two-story house. You have two floors. The bottom floor would correspond to your objective floor. So this is where objective truth resides. This is where things like knowledge and fact reside. And so if you think about the institutions in our culture, what are the institutions that are at home in the objective floor? Well, any of the sciences, right? The sciences deal with objective truth. The sciences deal with fact. So if you want fact, well, just scientifically prove it. Go to biology, go to chemistry, and you have this objective floor. There might be other things. Maybe we might put in, medicine. Sometimes we might put in law there. You know, things like that. That would be in the objective floor that applies to all. But then you have this other area of life, and it's the subjective floor of life. And in the subjective floor of life, it's a whole other floor that's actually disconnected largely from the objective floor. And in the subjective floor, this is where you put things that at the end of the day turn out to simply be personal preferences. So what goes up in the subjective floor? Well, of course, family traditions, right? Family traditions differ from family to family. These are not objective facts about the world. You just have your personal preferences when it comes to decorating at Christmas or celebrating birthdays or that kind of thing. So family traditions go up in there. You know, personal preferences in clothing or things like that might go up in there. But what else goes in that subjective floor? In our culture, we have relegated religion and morality to that subjective floor. That's why we see, when I do that test, we see that many people would argue that the moral and religious claims are merely subjective. And it's not because they've thought clearly through objective and subjective truth. It's just that they've been conditioned by the culture they live in to think of things this way. So it's not so much that they thought through this as much as they simply absorbed this from the culture. Now, so the subjective floor are your personal preferences. The objective floor is knowledge. These are facts. And these two floors are separate. And what our culture does is puts religion and morality in that upper floor. Now, think about the kinds of things that are subjective in nature. Do you spend your life, would you center your life around subjective truths? Are subjective truths the kind of truths that move your life and you base your life on? No, in fact, these subjective truths, if you think about it, I mean, think about your personal preferences in ice cream. Does your personal preference in ice cream play a major role in your life? Of course not. It simply fades to the background, doesn't it? And you bring it out when you walk into the ice cream store. That's when it plays a role. Okay? Now, and think about it. You're not gonna, if I walk into an ice cream store, what's a good ice cream here in Montana? Is there? Okay, I've never heard of any of those places you just mentioned. What's a real? You said Wilcoxon's. Never heard of it. Okay, apparently I'm gonna have to try it while I'm here. Okay. Yeah. Oh, wow. I'm seeing some passion come out in this guy. Okay. So let's say I walk into Wilcoxon, right? Did I say that correctly? Wilcoxon. Okay. All right. I go in there and I want to order Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream, and so I put my order in. But I hear another customer in the store there, and they order Rocky Road. Would I approach them and say, "Sir, I just want to share something with you. You actually ordered the wrong flavor. Come here. Let me show you the one true flavor. It's right here." Right? Am I going to do that? No, of course not. Am I going to stand outside of the ice cream parlor and hand out tracts that say Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream is the one true flavor? Right here, take this, sir. No, of course not. Because those are simply personal preferences. And personal preferences often just simply operate in the background of everyday life. Now think about it. If we approach our Christianity, if our theology, if our views about God and morality are simply subjective, where will they fade? To the background of life. In fact, this is exactly what we find. This book, Soul Searching, is a major study, the results of a major study that were done on the religious and spiritual lives of American teenagers. And what they found across the board, actually of American teenagers who were a part of any religion, they found that their religious views, their views about God, were mostly situated in the background of everyday living. They found that teenagers generally thought there was a God, he exists to kind of make them happy, he was needed when you got in trouble, but beyond that, he played no significant role in their lives, and he operated in the background. So that's not the kind of young person whose faith is going to inform much of their life. In fact, you see what this ends up doing? This view ends up short-circuiting our relationship with God. Now, if you want to make the Christian claims illegitimate, if you want to delegitimize Christianity, then all you have to do is, you don't have to argue against Christian claims, you don't have to give evidence, all you have to do is categorize it. So, Christopher Reeve, right, who's passed away now, but he was a famous actor, the first Superman. He was a quadriplegic from a tragic horse riding accident. He became a big advocate for medical research, and particularly stem cell research, right? And he wanted public policy on this. And he's before a crowd of Yale University medical students and researchers kind of advocating, and this is what he says. He says, when matters of public policy are debated, no religion should have a seat at the table. I don't object to anyone's religion. I'm a Unitarian myself. But we're talking about the promise of science, the ethics of science, not religion. Notice what he did. He took religion and put it in the second floor. Well, see, right now, as he's before these medical researchers, we're operating in that bottom floor. We're in the objective floor, and the objective floor has to do with science and public policy. And why should no religion have a seat at the table? Because this religion is up in the upper floor. You see, all he had to do was categorize it that way, and you can simply dismiss it. All right, I'm going to show you a video clip. This is actually from the vice presidential debate in 2008. I believe it was 2008, when Joe Biden and Paul Ryan were debating. And the issue of abortion came up. And I want you to hear how Joe Biden characterizes the issue and see if you can see the two-story house.
This debate is indeed historic. We have two Catholic candidates, first time on a stage such as this. And I would like to ask you both to tell me what role your religion has played in your own personal views on abortion. Please talk about how you came to that decision. Talk about how your religion played a part in that.
My religion defines who I am. And I've been a practicing Catholic my whole life. It has particularly informed my social doctrine. Catholic social doctrine talks about taking care of those who can't take care of themselves, people who need help. With regard to abortion, I accept my church's position on abortion as what we call de fide doctrine. Life begins at conception. That's the church's judgment. I accept it in my personal life. But I refuse to impose it on equally devout Christians and Muslims and Jews. I just refuse to impose that on others, unlike my friend here, the congressman. I do not believe that that we have a right to tell other people that women, they can't control their body. It's a decision between them and their doctor. In my view, in the Supreme Court, I'm not going to interfere with that.
Okay. So I just want you to recognize what's going on there. Whether you agree or not, at this point, I just want you to see how he characterized his religious views, right? These are de fide, right? What's that mean? Of faith. These are of faith. And so what did he do? He pushed those into the upper floor. And so without saying it, he implied, well, these are simply my subjective views. These are my personal views. I affirm them in my personal life, but I refuse to bring them down to the bottom floor and impose them on other people. So notice, you don't have to even argue against the view. All you have to do is categorize it as faith, and you can dismiss it out of the public conversation. And that has become a very powerful tool to simply dismiss the views of Christians. Right? Oh, you are against this? Well, that's because that's what your church teaches. Push it up in the upper floor. Right? And we can delegitimize it by saying, well, that's your religious view. And that's fine. You can have your personal, private religious view. Just don't try to bring it into public policy. You see? Now, that view has not always been the view of our country. In fact, maybe you're familiar with George Washington's farewell address, where he actually brings religion and morality front and center. Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizen. That's a very different answer than Joe Biden just gave. He's saying, no, religion and morality are indispensable supports. And so you can simply dismiss a view. You don't actually have to argue against it. And so what we have to do is we have to recapture a proper view of faith and reason and truth. And when we look in Scripture, Scripture does not teach a view where faith and reason are separated. In fact, I'll just take you through a few things quickly here. Acts chapter 17, Paul, it says, and according to Paul's custom, he went to the Jews, and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead. And in the very next verse, in verse 4, it says, and some were persuaded. And so giving reason and being persuaded and coming to faith are not mutually exclusive. Here we have an example where it's reason that actually brings someone to faith. And so going back to our definition of faith, what is faith? Well, Hebrews 11:1 says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. It doesn't say that it's a leap. Doesn't say that there is not, this is something we have to kind of throw logic and science and rationality out the door. No, it's the substance or the assurance of things hoped for. In fact, think about, how do you have assurance of something? If you bought a lottery ticket today, would you have assurance that you would win tomorrow? No, you would have no assurance. You would simply have blind hope. What if you had the ability, the power to know the future? If you knew what numbers were going to pop up tomorrow, if you had that knowledge and you bought a ticket today, would you have assurance that you would win? So what's the difference between assurance and hope there? It's the knowledge or the evidence. And there's evidence here that writer is suggesting there's evidence of things that aren't seen. See, not only do we believe in a material reality, we believe in an immaterial reality, and that there's actually evidence for that immaterial reality. And so when we come to a proper definition of faith, here's what I think we ought to do. Maybe set aside the word faith because it comes with so much baggage. Faith, upper floor, subjective floor. So faith, because it comes with that baggage, we may want to say, okay, let's replace it and use the word trust. Because the word trust actually communicates the biblical idea of faith. Faith is simply trust in what you have good reasons is true. Faith is trusting in what you have good reasons to believe is true. And so we want to throw this paradigm out. Faith is not opposed to reason, but what we want to do is bring those together and say, no, actually, faith is reasonable. Faith is supported by the evidence. In fact, think about it. I think an analogy of my relationship with my wife is very instructive here. The more knowledge and evidence I gain about my wife, what happens to our relationship? So we dated and were engaged for 2 years. Was my faith in my wife stronger after 2 years of dating, or is it stronger after 20 years of marriage? Well, it depends, doesn't it? It depends on what knowledge I've gained about her. So maybe the first 2 years before we're dating, she's fooling me. She's really hiding her true self. And we get married, and I discover her in lies, and I find her, saying she's one place when she's really somewhere else. And I mean, what's that going to do? What is that knowledge going to do to my faith in her? It's gonna take a hit, right? It's gonna decrease it. But thankfully, that's not been the case. Thankfully, over 20 years now, I've seen evidence upon evidence upon evidence that this woman is faithful. She's loyal to me. She's sacrificial. She's virtuous. She's honest. She's kind. And as I've gained that kind of knowledge about her, what has happened to my faith? It's increased. I want you to see the connection between knowledge and faith. My trust in her has increased so that I can travel around the country and not worry about her faithfulness to me at home because I have such a huge pile of evidence of who she is. And my knowledge about her increases my faith. It's not my faith or my trust in her isn't in spite of my knowledge. It's not divorced from my knowledge. No, it's because of my knowledge my faith grows. And in the same way, the more we know about God, the more evidence we have about him. When we know theology and apologetics, this should only strengthen our relationship with him, you see. That is the proper view of faith. So faith is not divorced from reason. And so, what do we mean? Let me kind of summarize this, okay? Christianity is objectively true. Christianity is objectively true. When we look at the claims of Christianity, they're objective claims. In addition to being objective claims, we would also want to argue that they are objectively true. That means they accurately describe the nature of all reality. So what I want you to do is, in your mind, is I want you to smash that two-story house. And you're going to have to begin to extract yourself from that and figure out, okay, what are ways in which I've been influenced by the culture to think about religion and morality, to think about my relationship with God in these ways, right? The reason why we are not huge on the knowledge of God, one of the reasons why, is because we actually don't think that theology is an area of knowledge or that Christianity is an area of knowledge. We primarily characterize Christianity as faith. Oh, that's faith. It's not knowledge. And there's a very different approach you take to faith and knowledge. And I want to bring those things together. Get rid of that two-story house. No, God is the creator of all reality. And so Christianity is an accurate description of that reality. Christianity is objectively true. That's why we ought to be Christians, because it's objectively true. And here's the other claim I would make. And we can know it's true. We can actually know it's true through the evidence and the reason that justify our faith. Knowledge is just true belief that is well justified. That's what knowledge is. And so I think we not only do we have true beliefs, but what we want to do is undergird those true beliefs with good reason. And so maybe some of you have a true belief that God exists. Okay, that's a good starting point, but I certainly don't want my children leaving my home and going off to college with merely a true belief that God exists. I want them to be able to walk out saying, no, I know God exists. How do I know? Well, because here is evidence one, evidence two, evidence three. There are all these clues that point to the truth. And so that is not merely a true belief, but it's a knowledge claim, you see. Okay, now there's a lot more we could say, but let me just give you a really great resource on this. This is, and I think it's probably a book that's really one of those books kind of in this cultural moment is essential reading. Because this two-story house just gets worse and worse. There are more things now that are even pushed into that subjective level. And so the whole conversation about gender, well, what's gender dependent upon? Your subjective personal preferences. And so we in the church need to really get clear on this. So Nancy Piercy has written a book called Total Truth. And that book, right, I mean, the first chapter there is a great introduction to this whole conversation. And so we have a few copies of this in the back. I would encourage you. This is a great read. They've actually added a study guide to it. It's something that I would say get and read in a small group together. To understand, this is a powerful thing that's going on in our culture, and there's all kind. I mean, you can look at the history and why this has happened, but what it's done is done tremendous damage to the cause of Christ in public in this culture. And so we need to recapture Christianity as the total truth about reality and walk back into the culture confidently with the gospel and with truth. Okay?
Excellent. Before we break, couple things, Brett. Stand up. Stay with us a second. Would you agree that this whole area is one of the most successful ploys that the secularists have used in terms of reductionism?
Yeah, and here's, I mean, you look at the history of this. this we are reaping the consequences of ideas that have been baking in Western civilization for hundreds of years. So you trace this back to kind of what's going on philosophically in the British Enlightenment and even beyond that, or before that with certain philosophers, and you see this trajectory. And you have someone like kind of a David Hume who's really instrumental in this. And really it has to do with our views of knowledge. But yeah, this is, I mean, a great ploy. Now, were people sitting there thinking, oh, we hear what's a ploy to undermine Christianity? Well, I don't know about that, but we certainly see how these ideas certainly have over time, and they come from a secular point of view. So, knowledge, the question of what is knowledge and how do we know what we know, these are all vital questions that are carefully tied into this whole issue.
For any of you, I would say this. Brett has started to unpack what I think is one of the most important subjects that we face as Christians. Because that upper story and that lower story, you don't cross those lines.
Yeah. And that's where our young people, all their faith is all up in that upper story. It's merely a subjective preference, and it's totally disconnected from their lives. And so that's why there's no difference in their lives, typically speaking, there's no difference in their lives than their secular counterparts.
And it's why Biden, for example, just as a practical example, when Biden is not going to cross that cultural boundary because he knows it's political suicide for the liberals. I would say to you, I've been tinkering with reading for about 45 years. I think Total Truth will really take this. I highly recommend it to you. It's probably one of the five best books I've read.
Yeah.
And so continue to work with this idea that he started to unpack. Let's take about 10 minutes and we'll come back together.